This is the Basketball Coaches Roundtable Podcast. I'm your host, Ben Newman. This episode, we welcome Chris Caputo as the guest of the roundtable. Coach Caputo is the associate head coach at the University of Miami. Coach Caputo, thank you so much for giving us your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let me just go around and introduce everybody that's sitting here at the roundtable with you. First, you have Alex Mirabel. He's the head coach of St. Peter's Prep and the head coach of the 18U Dominican Republic national team. You have LaWanda Green, L. Green. She's the head coach of VCAM High School in Brooklyn. You have Chris Ballerini. He's the head coach of DeWitt Clinton High School in the Bronx. And you have Dan Murphy, is the special assistant at Monmouth University. So, like I said, we're going to go around. We're going to hit you with some questions, if that's okay.
That's great. Happy to be on here.
So, and us being New York City, New Jersey guys, we're happy to have you on here, another New York City guy yourself. And I know you did go to Archbishop Molloy for high school, and you played for legendary coach Jack Curran. So I do have one story now, and then I'm going to get you with my question. Are you familiar with the wheelchair charity games?
Yeah, sure.
So Dan and I coached the Manhattan team, and we played against Elg, who was the head coach of the Brooklyn team, right? And so for a few years, we played him at Molloy. And so, right. Dan, you might remember this. Mr. Kumchowski, who's always there, taking us around and just going through the trophy case, you know, and just everything and knowing every detail about everything. And then he stops at Coach Curran's memorial there.
Right.
So being a New York City guy myself, and you being, and you having played for him, I know about him, but I don't know Coach Curran as a coach per se.
Sure.
But I want to know, having played for him, you know, can you say you have traits that you have attributed to him in your coaching style now?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that. I mean, certainly you never, you could never compare yourself to your mentors. And you certainly, somebody who's as successful and legendary as Coach Curran, I think, you know, the one thing I took from him that I think is probably why I coach is, you know, just, and I think Coach Larrañaga, who also played for him, you know, maybe the same way, like the impact he had on everyone in the program and the interest he took in their lives and their success and trying to help advance their careers by, you know, trying to get guys scholarships or opportunities to play in college, whether it be, you know, guys at the highest level, like I played with Buka Agbaye that played at Boston College, who's a great player there, or myself, who's, you know, like a bad Division III player. You know, the time that he took to try to help everybody. And then after that, you know, whether it be your job or whether that job be in basketball or in baseball, because he was a great baseball coach, or whether it be on Wall Street, or, you know, all the different walks of life that the players I thought, well, that's what coaching is. You know, it's not just the game that we love, but it's the impact you can have on people. And unfortunately, I don't know in our game today that any of us will ever coach anywhere like 50 years straight like he did, where you really feel like there's the connection, it lasts forever with all those people, because they're all coming back. And I think that's why, you know, at least for me, that's why I got into coaching. And then when you realize, oh, that doesn't really exist. There's no such thing as that anymore. You know, or there's very few of those guys. We're fortunate enough to coach in a league where, you know, I'm sure Coach Krzyzewski and Coach Boeheim and Coach Williams, you know, have that feeling because of how long they've been at their institutions. But most of us are never going to be in that situation, especially in this day and age, you know.
Thank you. Thank you. Alex Mirabel, you're up.
Hey, Coach. Hope all is well, man.
Hey, Alex.
Just a quick question, and it's very relevant. As a coach, you know, you've been coaching for many years, assistant coach at a high, you know, high levels. And obviously, we've seen the transfer portal go going crazy. It's like the stock market. You know, you wake up, it's like. So my question to you is that the way the basketball is going for college, or is it a way to kind of stop the madness? And you know, what's your opinion on that aspect?
Yeah, you know, we've benefited from the transfer portal in the past. You know, before there was a portal, when you had to get releases from schools, and you know, unfortunately, I don't know. I think in any walk of life, in any business, there's always like the risk reward of change. You know, even in the NBA, there's contracts. You can't just walk out because somebody, you know, yelled at you today. Or you know, if you're a rookie on a rookie deal and you know you're working your way into a rotation in the NBA, you know, you can't just walk out if you have a couple of bad games in a row, a couple of low minute games in a row. And unfortunately, well, that's not the case in college basketball, you know, especially now. I can understand the thought behind allowing people to transfer, but that doesn't mean I necessarily have to agree with it totally. And it's a hard one for me because I'm all for the athletes and what's in their best interest and their freedoms and their rights. And on the other hand, I think to myself, you know, is it always the best thing for a young person to leave when they're in adversity? You know, and I think most of us coaches would say, you know, there are times when a split, an amicable split, is the right thing. But there are other times when you feel like, hey, if this person would just sort of get focused and work a little bit harder and get hardened by their experiences, that they would really come out better in the end. And unfortunately, I don't know that a lot of people exist, you know, that exists for a lot of people. But that's probably just for our society in general. I don't know that that's just basketball players. I think we can generalize it because it's our sport. But I don't know. I hear a lot about millennials or people. I like to say I'm not a millennial because like 1980 is just a cutoff. Like I might be Gen X. I feel Gen X more than millennial as a person. But you know, it's a little bit of instant gratification and like Coach Pitino would say, a microwave society, you know. And I wonder what lessons will come, you know, from people bailing out all the time. And on the other hand, I think there's people who say, well, coaches leave, you know, they take new jobs or what have you. But, you know, there's contracts, there's, you know, there's buyouts, there's money exchange, you know, that can either stop a coach from being fired and leaving has to be paid out if you want to get rid of your coach. And so it's probably, truthfully, that one of the real conundrums of amateurism as it exists, where you have, you know, multi-billion-dollar sort of Division I basketball operation that is also acting as a nonprofit amateur sport, and just that in itself is going to create all sorts of like hypocrisy that I don't think anybody's got a great answer for.
Thank you.
I don't know if that answered the question.
No, you did. Yeah.
No, I think you hit the nail on the head with that one. L Green, you're up.
Hey, Chris, thanks again for coming. I think we're all on the same line. And just to speak about the transfer, I remember my coach from Ohio State freshman year, I wanted to go. But back then you had to, like 1995, 96, you had to go to the AD and you have to really sign a paper, because back then it was a 4-year, you know, scholarship, and she would not let me go. And, you know, she eventually got fired and I transferred. But it was like, I still think about staying and transferring to another school. But these kids, you hear them all the time, they transfer and it's like, everyone is in their ear. I think that's the main issue. Everybody's telling them what they should do or what they not do. With that said, my question to you is, with the new, I'm trying to be politically correct, with the new type of player we have now, how do you incorporate discipline when kids are just not like showing up, whether if you are doing like a Zoom or a workout or anything, or say, I just watched The Last Shoe like twice already. The basketball one, I watched it like twice and probably watched it again today, dealing with like a Joe Hampton type of guy who's very emotional, who's played at every level, who's played and feels like he should deserve more. And we all know as coaches, that can be a cancer, you know, and that can break your team. How do you deal with that with this temperature that we have now? I'm sorry if I was long.
No, those are great questions. You know, I think all, and you know, first let me say this, like I've got so much respect for public high school coaches. I couldn't even begin to tell you, you know, having played in a private school league and everything. And, for me, you know, the respect I have for coaches of public schools where, hey, look, you're not necessarily recruiting. You're really doing incredible work with people in a lot of times in your community of where your school is. And so it's easy for us to say, well, maybe in the recruiting process, we can sort that out to some degree, you know. And a lot of times in that process, you know, I'm sure Alex, you probably in this situation, you can look at the people around the kid to have a sense of you're going to have any chance of, you know, getting through to them, to the kid, because the people around them, you know, will tell you if are we going to be partners in this person's development and their chance to, you know, if it's get a college scholarship or go to college, or in our case, you know, everybody, hey, becoming an NBA player, becoming a professional basketball player, getting a degree, like, are we partners in this together? And if we are, kids will be kids, right? If you're 18 years old, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to have an approach or an attitude about things that we're going to have to adjust. But if I can't anticipate that we're going to be partners, then I know it may be very, very hard for us to help that person forward, you know? And I think, you know, the more truths we have to be truth tellers, the more truths we can get to them, the better. And sometimes that can be harsh, but again, I think that's where the support of, hey, if his high school coach is on the same page with me and his AU coach is on the same page with me and the parents are on the same page with me and the trainer's on the same page with me, guess what? We can move this person forward. Doesn't mean that there's not going to be bumps along the road, but that there's not going to be anywhere that this person can go to give an excuse or tell a story to, or allow that their view of the world at 16, 17, 18 years old is somebody's going to tell them what they want to hear. But last thing I would say, you know, the discipline thing is, I think it's just got to be consistent throughout your program. And again, I know sometimes that's hard because there, you know, hey, you know, there are circumstances and how much flexibility you're going to have and how do you treat everybody? Do you treat them the same or you treat them all fairly? Those are things for you and your institution and your own, you know, how you feel comfortable with the situation. But I think you have to be sincere, you have to be honest, and you got to hope that you got partners amongst their people.
Chris Ballerini, DeWitt Clinton High School.
Hey, Coach. Thanks again, man, for coming. I got more of a basketball-centric question here.
Now, sure.
You're known a little bit to be more on the defensive side of the ball. Defending the three transition-wise, what's your teaching points? Are you running at guys? Are you running to zones? What are you trying to teach your guys early in the season?
It's a great question. You know, I think the first thing, and it's funny, it's a discussion that we've had a good bit. In transition specifically, the balance between getting them to run as hard as they possibly can back, but then also understanding you do not have a man in transition that you need to talk and we need to get matched up, is a very difficult thing to create in practice, I think. In a sense that, you know, if you said, hey guys, like, we don't have men, just get matched up. Now I get the sense that they're not going to run quite as hard, you know, because they can just point and say, hey, I'm good here and you're good there. And that often doesn't work, right? If you said, hey, just, you have to run as hard as you can. Well, that becomes hard, particularly when teams play zone or with all the switching that's going on right now, right? Because you and I might be, or we might, both Chris's might be matched up, but you guys are in a zone and I'm cutting and I'm flashing and I'm running the baseline and all of a sudden, you know, you're at the elbow on the right side of the floor and I'm in the left corner. And now the shot goes up and you're taking off and like, I'm sprinting my ass off to you, but you know, somebody else is standing right next to you and you guys are together. And so now, so I think, you know, the combination of how do you get them to run as fast as they possibly can, as hard as they possibly can transition, because that gives you the chance. How do you teach the communication piece in transition? And how do you create that in practice for those scenarios where there are going to be problems? You know, how do you create those problems in practice? Is it, hey, we're going to come down and run zone offense and then sprint back man and have the zone team not even have to take the ball out to try to create it really difficult, a difficult situation, right? We're going to come down and run dummy offense. The zone team, the team that's coming on offense on the baseline. And so within our dummy offense, we're never going to be necessarily at the end of the play matched up with our guy. And then again, they take off as fast as they can and they're running. And then, so doing those things, getting the sprint as hard as they can, get them to talk. I think the other thing is, you know, you talk about the, a lot of times the trailer does not, you know, if the first big is running to the rim, then you've obviously got to get to the rim and meet that guy early at the free throw line and try to fight him into the post. But the second big, and again, in high school, is not even one big, let alone two. Like a lot of times we've got to be running and up to touch and close enough to the ball to load up the gaps, load to the ball, but up at the 3-point line, ready to defend maybe drag pick and rolls, or maybe just a quick reversal into a three. Like, and I think that's a mistake a lot of times bigger guys make if they're the second one down and they're running to the paint, but their man is running to the 3-point line. And now they're already in a closeout because yeah, they've run hard to the paint, but we don't know personnel well enough to know, look, your guy's going to be trailing and trying to catch and shoot threes or running the quick pick and roll. So I think it's probably one of the hardest things to do. And I don't think it's like rocket science, but I think what you've got to do is come up with, hey, how do I create this problem in practice? And I think it, you know, I'm sure you guys have all, you know, paid attention to all this stuff that people talk about these days. Like, it's got to get messy first in practice. Then I think, you know, you got a good drill. And then how do you refine that, whether it be on film or, you know, one thing I heard Jim Crutchfield say down at, he's at Nova Southeastern, he's a legendary, you know, Division II coach that plays really, really fast. And if you're having a problem getting guys to run hard or girls to run hard, like take a guy with the ball, put him at the free throw line. I'm sorry, put him at the half court. Take your other player, put him underneath the basket, no ball. The guy at half court, tell him to go run in to the opposite basket of where your other player is and shoot a layup. As soon as he takes off, the kid at the other 94 feet away, your job is to run as fast as you can and rebound this thing before it hits the ground. And you'd be shocked to see how easy that is to do if they're running really, really hard. But they've got to really run. And then when you see that, you're like, okay, you did that. Now, why don't you run like that back defensively? You know, why don't you run like that, even if it's on offense and you're talking about sprinting the floor and getting to the corners or what have you? So I think understanding how hard they have to run and how they have to be in front of the ball, but then also creating in practice some messy situations to where they're really going to have to learn to communicate and get matched up.
No, thanks, Coach. That's fantastic.
I think that's funny because what really drew me to you and asking you to come on was when you spoke at Alex's clinic for the New Jersey coaches and you were talking about transition defense, you know, and
I wanted to pick a topic that was like really no one would ever pick and also that like I don't have any great answers to, so I just threw all my thoughts out there to see
funny,
it would help me think about it, you know.
Well, that was funny because I think, you know, that's what was like, yeah, like I want to talk more to this person because you were like, I think you were genuinely asking everybody watching, like, if you have anything else to give me, because I don't really have the answers this is just what we do. And I think to quote you, you're like, I think kind of what we do kind of sucks, but you know, it's
yeah, and
about,
I would say when I say that, I think it's a lot of transition drills suck because
right.
they don't necessarily create the situation that you're going to get in practice, you know, every day. Like we're going to take a bad shot in the game probably, right? Our teams, but yet like when you do the transition drill, no, you'll some coach shoots it like from three and everybody's like kind of watching and getting back, right? Or we're going to turn it over. Like your best transition defense is don't turn it over. Don't take a terrible shot. Don't be at the rim, miss, and be on the ground. I mean, how many of those guys do? Like your smaller guards are in the, you know, I'm going to go take off on one foot and lay it in and he misses and he, oh, I got fouled and he's on the ground and now they're frigging taking off. And automatically there's a guard, maybe even with the ball, that has it. So I think they play together.
Yeah, absolutely. But it was just like the combination of everything that you were saying was like, I connected with it. And so I appreciated what, you know, what you were saying. Dan Murphy, Monmouth University.
Yes, sir. All right. So thank you, Coach, for joining us and to keep it on maybe some more basketball specific topics. Oh, the assistant.
What's the assistant's name?
Yeah. Oh, this is Abigail. Who's your favorite team,
Abby?
Monmouth, that's right. Fly Hawks. So, I mean, everything is so topical that the guys are bringing up right now with like the portal and discipline and all these types of things. And that's awesome. But, you know, to be honest, I haven't watched a ton of Miami basketball. I'm sure you know how that goes. You can't, you know, you have X amount of hours in a day. You can only watch so many games, especially with all the things that we have to do. But I know on like your roster, there's a ton of Northeast guys. So I check in more so like how the players are doing because we played against a bunch of these guys when I was at Anthony High School, like Eastside guys, Life Center, like, you know, so on and so forth, Blair, you know. So I follow like the players more than the team. So my apology for not checking on you guys enough. But
right.
I was just curious if you could explain like Miami basketball, what it is on the offensive and defensive side of the ball. Like, are you sets or motion, up-tempo?
Yeah.
Or more in the half court defensively, pressure, pack, multiple defenses. Like, just I'm just more curious with your guys' system, if you could kind of share that with us.
Well, you know, I think, you know, starting back, I'll talk defensively first. You know, we've played mostly man historically. I think there's only one year in my 19 years that we've played zone. We played a matchup with a team that had a lot of like size guys and didn't have a great ability to keep the ball in front of us. And when I tell you, like, the matchup was like makeshift, it was like makeshift. It was like, you know, us man-to-man coaches trying to play zone. And that year we had Ralph Willard came and met with us and talked about his matchup, and Bernie Fine, you know, came in to talk about the 2-3 zone at Syracuse and kind of like morphed it. And we actually got pretty good at it. But it was funny. I mean, like every game you sort of like change it a little bit. Hey, guard this guy, don't guard this guy, go on this, go over this trap. You know, it was really a funny year. And I always feel like that's what it's like for man coaches that try some zone, because you spend so much time putting the emphasis on man details, and I don't think I'll get in trouble for this, but like when the Heat started playing zone, like Coach Spoelstra and I are good friends, and they first started doing it, and I was like, I don't know, I saw it and I texted him like, oh, like played zone last night, huh? How about that? And he goes, yeah, I don't know the rules of it. And I was like, LOL. And he's just like, no, I'm not kidding, like I don't know the rules. He's like, yeah, I'm like, and now he's like the zone master, you know, and like all the, yeah, look at how they played the zone. And I'm like, dude, wasn't this like 3 years ago? You were saying like, you didn't even know the rules of this, you know, throw it out there. So there's a guy who's a great man-to-man defensive coach and looking for a change and looking for a change up. And he's such a humble guy. He was honest enough to say, yeah, we're, you know, kind of playing around with this thing. I don't know that we've created the amount of detail that we normally do, but you know, I think how you defend pick and rolls in the man is the biggest thing. There are teams in our league that that really pressure and deny. But I think the reality is you play against great guards. Unless you have, like Florida State has done in the past, although they're not, they don't do it quite as much this year, as good as they are. Like if you've got 12 guys and three shot blockers and you want to pressure 94 feet and don't let anybody throw passes and get the game going like this, that is a way to play. It's just not a way to play for a lot of teams, right? Because ultimately the guards in our league are really, really good. You potentially put yourself in some sort of some foul trouble. You potentially ask yourself, are you expanding so much energy doing that? And what are you getting out of it? Now, if you're turning people over at 22, 23%, you know, different story. But most of us, you know, it's harder to do. So we would be more gaps or pack pick and roll team. I mean, defensive team. And then so much of it then comes down to your personnel, how you can play pick and rolls with your personnel. You know, obviously I think 10 years ago, 15 years ago in college, when pick and roll offense was not as intricate, you know, when it was middle high pick and roll or side pick and rolls, you know, if you could play it one way as a team and get really good at that one way, then I think that would be a good way to do it. But now with the amount of shooting that's on the floor, even at our level now, like at the five, you have to have multiple ways of playing it, no matter who your personnel is. So, you know, whether you're switching one through five, whether you're trying to double switch potentially if you've got issues in your backcourt and things like that. So, you know, playing man, playing in the gaps, trying to be pretty tough on the ball, trying to load up the lane, trying to protect the lane, and then those decisions that really are personnel based on how you play pick and rolls. And then offensively, you know, I think we've been a pick and roll offensive team, and, you know, you're trying to blend that idea of giving a high amount of freedom, but also holding guys accountable to taking good shots and not turn the ball over. And yet also wanting to make sure you have some things in your packages that allow you to maybe be a little bit more patterned and predictive of kind of what you want. So much of it is personnel.
No, thank you. I appreciate that because, you know, even within your conference and your play, you're out of conference, we see a lot of different styles of play. And our style of play is like a little bit unique. We have like a unique style. Not everyone plays like the way that we play. So I'm just curious to hear like how other people play and why they play that way. And there's a lot of different ways to win. You know, you were talking about the more gap pack teams. Those teams have had success. And then there's teams that force a lot of turnovers and they have success. And then there's teams that play only in the half court and they have success. And then you have some up-tempo teams that have success. So a lot of different ways to do it. And I just appreciate you sharing that, the insight on that.
Well, I think the other thing that I would say, like in our league, the one thing is you do have, just like in most leagues, I'm sure, but particularly for us, there's so many different styles on every night. That's the unique thing. And I think the more flexibility you have, like, you're going to play Syracuse on Monday and they've got obviously a great zone. You're going to play, you know, then Carolina on Saturday and they're really making it hard to throw passes and, you know, so big at the rim. Then you're going to go and play Virginia and it's going to be a very low possession game against a very disciplined physical defensive team. You know, then you might play Florida State the next game. They're pressing you and sort of like pressuring all the way up the floor and making passes tough. You know, then you play, you know, who kind of plays like Princeton on offense or some Princeton-esque things, and then plays like a 1-1-3 zone in the gaps, like a lot of different things. So I think the more flexible you are while staying, you know, somewhat consistent in what you can do, the better. And it's easier said than done. And having better players, as many good players as you can have, that allows you to do that as best you can, you know.
I think that's one of the things that makes your conference so great, in my opinion, is like every school has their identity of like of what they do, you know. I want to pass the ball back to Alex Mirabel.
Hey, Coach, just want to ask you more of a personal question. I know you have a family, young kids, wife. So, as a high major coach, how do you juggle that? Because I'm not good at it as a high school coach. So I don't know how you're doing it.
Yeah, it's not easy.
What's your game plan, coach? What's your
I mean, it's not easy. I mean, I learned from Coach Larnig a while back. Like I think had spent so much time back in the day in the 70s where there's no recruiting rules. You know, you could be in the car, you know, 300 days a year, and he was gone a lot. And I think at some point he said, hey, this is not really sustainable for somebody with a family, and what kind of, you know, what kind of life do you want to have if this is what it's going to be? And I think that what you learn is you try to include them in as much as you're doing as possible. And I didn't necessarily understand that when I was younger, but when you see it, you know, it's really important that you find ways to include them in those things, you know, because there are some time demands that you can't get around, right? Travel and recruiting and, you know, all the different things we do and scouting. And the other thing I would say is, quite honestly, like, don't have a lot of hobbies, you know. I mean, if you like to play golf, if you're on a softball team, if you, you know, like to go, you know, I don't know, do all sorts of other things, I don't see how you can be good at doing our job and then being a parent as well. So, you know, you sort of sacrifice in those personal freedoms or whatever you call them.
I think we're all struggle in that department, in that balance. L. Green, VCAM High School.
My second question is for the coaches, high school coaches, and the athletes. What are you looking for? What should they be working on? What are you looking for in a player, especially from the inner city, like a kid that has D1 aspirations? I laugh because, yeah, I laugh. They have D1 aspirations of playing at Miami or North Carolina or a Virginia Tech. Like, what should they be able to do well?
Well, I think there's a lot of intangible things, but if we were talking about tangible things, you know, some of the things, and this is a hard thing to tell people, is, you know, at the Division I level, that you're really, your size for your position is a factor. It's not everything, but it's something, right? And it doesn't matter. The reality is that that's one of the things that you can't control, but, you know, whatever size you are, you know, in today's game, I think trying to become skillful at a young age, you know, pass, dribble, and shoot is so important and it sounds simple, but I think we all know there's a lot of guys and girls who can't pass, dribble, and shoot. You know, that, let's face it, I mean, for most of us in recruiting, the skill piece is what we recruit, and we hope that we can coach them on the defensive end. But the thing that I think we have a hard time maybe kind of, you know, trying to evaluate is the competitive piece. You know, your competitive spirit is probably the most important thing you could have. And trying to figure that out, you know, your passion for the game, your competitive spirit, those things, your coachability, like those things are, I would much rather a high competitive person than like a workout guy. And I think in this day and age, you know, we have to remind our players all the time, like, look, working out, I'm all for it. And I'm, but like, you get judged on how you compete. So I don't really want to see your workout videos if you don't run the floor back defensively, right? I don't want to see your workout videos if you don't embrace contact, or this is a contact sport, you know? And so, you know, I think from that perspective, the competitiveness is so important.
Hey, Chris Ballerini, one-man press break. You're up.
Yes, sir. All right, Coach. You like defense. I like defense. So let's have another defensive question. All right. Now, you're the defensive coordinator. You come in at halftime. What analytics are you looking at? Like, what's the number one or two things? It's halftime. Yeah. What are you kind of highlighting every game? And you're like, hey, we're reaching our goal here today. We're not.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different things after the game. But, I mean, the simplest one for me, I think when you look at the end of the day, the one that coincides the most with success, and it's the simplest one, is your field goal defense, you know? And if you look at the best teams in college basketball, you know, you can take the numbers and put them any way you want, But the teams that make people miss the most are the most successful teams. There's just no doubt about that. So I'm looking there. You're certainly looking at the rebounding percentages to see where we're at there. A lot of times you're going to look at offensive turnovers, because I think a lot of times that could determine if you're giving up transition baskets, which you can't defend, right? But I mean, it's to me very that simple in the defensive end. Is like, are we making them miss? Which means a lot of times we're forcing bad shots or what have you. Now that's our team. If you're Shaka Smart, 12 years ago or 10 years ago at VCU, it's probably, hey, I don't really care about the field goal defense. I'm looking at the turnovers. What rate are we turning them over? Because obviously that's their defense is predicated on that. But for me, I think there's a lot of things we can talk about, points per possession, what have you. That's one of them. We'll get the points for possession every time out or whatever. But like, are we making them miss?
Yeah. And as a high school coach, it's heartening to hear that, right? Because we don't have the numbers coming in.
Yeah.
Right. But we definitely could keep rebound margin, keep, turnovers and, to a close, probably field goal percentage. So that is cool.
Yeah.
Oh, that's you brought up a great point, coach. Something that, kind of like we always talk to our guys about as well. It's like making them miss, because we track our stops a lot in drills and we're always trying to get that three stops in a row.
Yeah, sure.
Which is something I would suggest too, Chris. Like that's not that one is not
that that's a good difficult. One too. Yeah.
Like analytically to stop, if you can't get the percentages of, I know how it is. You have the manager on the bench or this or that, but our guys try to keep it themselves during the game. Yeah. Like that's one of the things we do to keep our benching game. So like that's one, that's two, this is for the kill. But I'm just wondering, what do you think is the biggest challenge facing college coaches today? And then I feel like as coaches, we're all very good at like pointing out what the issues are, like, oh, that's wrong, that's messed up. But like to whatever challenges you're seeing, what do you think are some of the solutions? I'm just open-ended question.
Yeah, I mean, I think the transfer thing we talked about is a challenge to every coach, it seems, these days. It used to be the grad transfer was a problem for friends of mine that were coaching at the mid-major level. That wasn't the case 10 years ago when I was at the mid-major level. We didn't lose guys much up ever, I don't think, but certainly not like that. How do you build a program at that level? How do you build a program when you're losing? Because a lot of times there's guys who have numbers on losing teams, particularly young players. You hope that, hey, maybe this experience has given them a chance to grow. And as they grow, our team will become better as we add more pieces, except those guys leave and transfer because they don't think you don't know what you're doing. So I think those are how you manage that. Again, if I was thinking about a solution, it's like anything. We have to adapt, right? We have one thing in college coaching is we got to understand there's more jobs than ever today in college coaching. We're all a million different positions, even at a lot of schools. There's not as the barriers to entry are probably a little bit less difficult to Division I level as there may have been 20 years ago, with all the different positions. I'm sure, too, I think people are making more money, quite frankly, than they were making 20 years ago. Maybe at the college level, as difficult as it is, and you see, today's a day where a lot of people are, there's job changes, but the reality is that the jobs are paying better wages, relative even to inflation, I think, than there was, 20 years ago. And so with that comes, the scrutiny of, but I think, look, we're probably all looking at what's our team look like in every 1 year. And whoever can do a better job creating a better environment to attract either your own players back or other players who are leaving to your place, whatever environment, the better your environment, I think the better off you'll be. And that's probably the best solution to all this is like, hey, guys, we've got to create a great environment. We might lose a guy. The San Antonio Spurs have an incredible environment. They lost Kawhi Leonard. It happens. But like by creating a good environment, you can get people, coming and being attracted to your place.
I appreciate that. That's good because as we've all mentioned with the transfer thing, now with everyone getting an extra year, that just, now you have all your seniors yeah, I mean, they would have just graduated and now they can all go. So that just throws the whole, you know, throws another wrench in the whole equation. So see how it all goes.
It's going to be wild.
Murph, you brought up a good point. So I have two final questions for you. First is, how are you approaching, you know, this upcoming year with everybody getting, you know, a free year essentially?
Well, I think, you know, the biggest thing is we happen to have a number of seniors, but, you know, just trying to educate those guys as best you can and help them make the best decision they can. And obviously with COVID and just the world as it is, it's a little bit different than a normal year. In some ways, those guys got a great gift because a lot of times they're seniors who maybe didn't have the type of year they wanted, or in our case, we had some injuries. And, you know, in some ways you look at it like, wow, you got a golden ticket maybe to come back and give it a chance. But you try to provide as much information as possible, you know, using the resources that you have.
How is that affecting you with the incoming class?
Not too much yet, but, you know, I think everyone will have to see what that looks like, you know, as the dust settles for every program, because it'll be different, you know.
Right, right. And then my final question is, in your conference, I think you have two teams that have the most signature defense, at least in the Northeast, with Syracuse and their 2-3 zone and Virginia with their pack line. Mm-hmm. I can go from game to game, and without a doubt, the game that I'm coaching, the other team is either yelling out Syracuse, and that's their, everyone knows that's their 2-3 zone, you know, or if they're playing man, it's a pack line, you know, and most of the time they're calling out Virginia. Can you give us simple rules to attacking
the simplest one that even the Syracuse guys would say is, you know, if there's somebody in the middle of that zone that can not only score a pass, you know, that can give them a problem, you know. But, you know, they adjust the zone so well. So it's hard. You know, sometimes in the past we would get some things and then come out of a timeout or a halftime, Coach Boeheim adjusts and you sort of take that thing away and you got to find something else. You better be able to make a few threes that night as well. Although we've had a couple of good games against them where we didn't make quite as many threes as you would have thought. But, you know, Pitt beat them a long time with Jamie Dixon because the offensive rebounded back in that day, you know. And then I think the pack line, you know, you got to understand that you're probably not – you need to be physical with the ball because they're very physical. So if you're soft with the ball, that's not good. And then understanding, like, look, you're not going to probably get it on the first side of the floor. It's going to require some patience to beat them. And that's one of the things about – they play such deliberate – on offense to almost get you impatient when you get the ball, you know, it sort of plays together. It's the old football. If you want to play better defense, play less of it, you know? And so as good as they are at what they do, part of what they do is to have to do less, believe it or not.
Coach Chris Caputo, thank you so much for your
Thanks,
time.
Guys. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Very candid, very open, really appreciative.
That's great. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Coach. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Basketball Coaches Roundtable Podcast. Remember to follow us on Twitter @BCRPodcast11.